You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, if you've ever wondered how fireworks are created, we'll share the science behind those pyrotechnics. First, freshman Congressman Mike Gallagher is a Republican from Green Bay. He hasn't been on the job very long, but has already gotten attention for a bill he introduced that targets Congress itself. The bill would cancel Congress's legislative recess if it failed to pass a budget. Last week, Gallagher said again that Congress should not go on its August recess if it doesn't pass a budget in that time. Here's a clip from a speech on the House floor.
In 7 weeks, we're going to adjourn on a month-long vacation without reforming the tax code or getting our appropriations done. And just 30 days after returning from the August recess, if we don't make some hard choices, the government may shut down, cutting our constituents from access to the programs they depend on for their livelihoods. So my message is simple. Let's work through the August recess, because in what other job would you grant yourself a month off if you hadn't gotten your work done?
Christina Marcos is a staff writer for The Hill and covers the House, and she joins us now to tell us more. Christina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you, too. And we just heard a little bit of Representative Gallagher speaking last week, but this is not the first time he has called to cancel a recess. What other opportunities has he taken to make that case?
He's a freshman, of course, and so it seems his main message when he's come to the floor in his first several months in office has been, hey, we shouldn't go home just yet because we still have work to do. So this is something that he's been bringing up for a lot in the last several months, but leadership, of course, has still been sending members home for their regular recess weeks.
And what kind of reception does this kind of firebrand talk get in Congress, changing the way that things are done?
Well, what's interesting is that this sort of rhetoric of we should stay in town to get the people's work done, that's something you usually hear from someone in the minority party. So it's really unusual to hear that from someone in the majority. And there, it's more than just Congressman Gallagher who's been bringing up this message. Several House Republicans and Senate Republicans have been calling on their leadership in recent weeks to stay at least through part of August because they don't feel like they're getting much progress on their agenda at the moment.
So is there a chance that that could actually happen?
It's not. Nothing's impossible, of course, but it's an annual tradition in Congress to take the month off, and it's not as if members of Congress are going to the beach for an entire month. That's not accurate. I mean, they do schedule various events back in their districts and states, and international trips abroad with other members of Congress. These things are scheduled months ahead of time. So if they were actually cut off part of the August break, there are all sorts of pre-scheduled activities and meetings that they have that they would have to reschedule.
Now, Representative Gallagher is early, as we said, in his congressional career. Does this kind of advocacy that he's making for Congress to keep working and that high-profile demands that he's making, does that indicate anything about his reputation in Congress or what we might expect from him, do you think?
Well, he's clearly someone who wants to shake up the status quo. A lot of members of Congress, they come in wanting to do things. They want to get things done for their constituents. And so it's frustrating, especially for someone who's brand new to this job, to see that it actually takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to get much of anything done around here, especially when Congress is so gridlocked like it is today.
Now, typically, as I understand it, there might be a House budget resolution by April 2nd. It's almost July, though, and House Republicans still struggling to pass a budget and start the reconciliation process. What do we know about what's holding them up?
It's the same fight that's held up Republicans for years. There are some more moderate Republicans who don't want to impose huge cuts to domestic programs, like, for example, food stamps or other programs for public housing, things like that. And then you also have the faction of Republicans, the defense hawks, who want more funding for defense spending. And then you have the conservatives who want to cut spending across the board, across the federal government. So it's very hard to get a compromise that satisfies all three of those factions. And so what we're seeing right now is that they're unable to find at least even a baseline number that they can all agree upon. And that's therefore holding up the rest of their agenda on tax reform. And keeping the government open.
Now, the Freedom Caucus had been pretty active when it came to sounding off on the health care bill in the House. Where does the Freedom Caucus stand on the budget?
They are calling for deep cuts to domestic spending because they insist, well, surely there's something that we can cut somewhere. But they're encountering resistance from members of the House Appropriations Committee who are trying to explain to them, well, it's not really that easy that we could do something like that.
We are talking to Christina Marcos right now, staff writer for The Hill, and she's joining us to talk about the House budget process. Also, we've been talking about Congressman Mike Gallagher, a Republican from Green Bay, who called for Congress to cancel its legislative recess if the House doesn't pass a budget. And as you were getting at, Christina, a recent blueprint of the budget would boost defense spending, cut millions from entitlements and welfare programs. Who would be on board with that in the House?
Well, President Trump's budget actually fell along those lines, and he proposed some very steep cuts to domestic programs like public housing and a whole host of other things. So they probably could find an ally in President Trump, but he's not really very involved in these negotiations at the moment.
And Speaker Paul Ryan, also from Wisconsin, has said that passing the budget is necessary to reform the tax code. How does the tax code end up getting rolled into the budget in Paul Ryan's version of things?
Well, because Republicans are trying to pass tax reform in the same way they are with health care, which is through this process in the Senate where they can avoid a filibuster from Democrats. So by using this procedure called reconciliation, they only need a simple majority to pass it. And since that will only require a simple majority, but it has to apply to with a budget. And so they need to pass a budget first in order to get tax reform rolling using that procedure. They could, of course, pass tax reform without this reconciliation process, but they would need help from Democrats.
Right, and does that look like a possible option at all? Are there Democrats who are interested in working across the aisle like that?
There's actually some more appetite from Democrats on tax reform because there are a lot of business-minded, more centrist Democrats who genuinely do want to see some changes with the tax code. You're not going to see that kind of help on health care because Democrats have uniformly taken a position that they're not going to work with Republicans unless Republicans agree to drop talk of repeal.
And so, Christina, as we said, the clock is ticking on this. What do you see as the next moves for Republicans?
Well, when they come back, because right now, this week they're off back in their districts for the Independence Day holiday. When they come back, they're only here for 3 more weeks before they're scheduled to leave for the 5-week-long August break. So they've got there's passing a budget that they'd like to do before they leave, potentially raising the debt ceiling. And in the Senate, they're really hoping to get this health care bill done so they can move on to tax reform.
And do you see any kind of collateral damage in the public eye that Republicans, they're the majority party in Congress now, and yet they're still having such a hard time even within the party grappling with these different positions? Do you see the public having a negative perception that there could be some cost to having this trouble working things out and being a leading party?
Absolutely. I mean, Republicans spent the entirety of President Obama's terms in office saying, well, we did have Republican control of the House, the Senate, and the White House in order to accomplish our priorities. And they've been handed that opportunity, and they still aren't having trouble moving their priorities through Congress. But the reality is we've seen over the last several years that Republicans are a very fractured party. And as I referenced earlier, what they're trying to accommodate these three different factions among House Republicans to reach an agreement on the budget. It's been that way since President Obama came into office, and they're still the same fractured party as they were. They just also have President Trump in the White House. It doesn't mean they're any better at reaching agreements among themselves.
Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Christina Marcos, staff writer for The Hill, and she joined us to talk about Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Green Bay, talking also about the House's Republican struggle to pass a budget. Right now, it's Independence Day, and no doubt a lot of us will be heading out to see a fireworks display tonight. They're super fun to watch, but have you ever wondered what makes fireworks tick or go boom? Well, to help us better understand the actual science behind fireworks, Rob Ferret recently spoke with Bassam Shakashiria, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison.
Bassam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Very happy to be with you on this very special day, Independence Day. It's a day when we celebrate freedom, and we celebrate it in so many different ways, including enjoyment of the fireworks.
Well, let's start with a basic chemical reaction from the firecracker to the big ones in the sky. Some fire equals a burst of sound and light. What is happening?
What is happening is a combination of chemical transformations that affect the senses. We all enjoy fantastic explosions and the brilliant light displays that the fireworks emit. We enjoy them because they appeal to the senses. It's what we hear and what we see. These spectacles that we enjoy are much more than just a form of entertainment. There's a lot of science involved in precisely forming the assembly of chemicals and fuel that are carefully mixed together by experts. I want to emphasize that. Fireworks are to be made by experts and are to be set off by experts only. When they're set off, they produce very particular effects in color, red, blue, yellow, green, for example, and they produce a lot of sound energy, and also the third form of energy that they produce is heat. So these three forms of energy that are produced, light, sound, and heat, are what they appeal to us, except that we're too far from them, we can't feel the heat.
Now let's talk about those colors. What is it in one firework that makes it green, say, and another one that makes it red or blue?
Well, the different chemicals that are put in there, each has its own particular signature. It's like a thumbprint. For example, green is a mixture of the compounds of barium chloride, for example. Red, strontium salts, lithium salts are also used. Or orange involves calcium salts. Blue, the beautiful blue that we see, is the result of copper compounds, copper chloride, for example. And then you can mix those and produce different colors. For example, purple is produced by mixing strontium, which causes red color to be emitted, and copper, which causes blue color to be emitted. And these colors are emitted because of the heat of the reaction that excites the specific metal that's involved there to a higher energy level. And the electrons are excited to a higher energy level, and then when they drop back to their original state, they release energy in the form of light, and each element has its own characteristic thumbprint, its own signature. So as I said, the red is from strontium or lithium, green is from barium compounds, blue is from copper, and then, you know, a whole bunch of other combinations.
Staying with the visual side, sometimes we might see one with sparkling dots, some with streamers. How do we make them flow in that way differently?
Well, this is where the experts get into the picture. It is really both an art and a science to put the fireworks together and to launch them safely. That's why I want to emphasize again the importance of obeying all the safety rules when we are involved with the use of fireworks. Experts should be setting them off. So the design of the shell, the design of the firework, and from the time it's lifted off until it reaches up in the sky, and the visual effect, as you call it, and I call it the same thing too, the visual effect is the streaming, or a star is burst, or cascading orange, or cascading red. All of this is the result of how the shell is put together in the first place.
We're talking to Bassam Shakashiri. He's a professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, looking at the science behind those 4th of July fireworks. Let's turn to the sound now, Bassam. Sometimes there's the loud thud sound. Sometimes there's the sizzle or the sparkling sound. What makes the sound different from one firework to the next?
Well, once again, it is the way the firework shell is put together, and how it is released, and how it's carefully choreographed in terms of the sequence of events that take place. So you need to get the firework up in the sky before the second stage is ignited. That causes both the light emission and the sound that is to be what we hear. You know, sound travels slower than light. So light travels about a million times as fast as sound. We all know the speed of sound is about 300,000 meters per second. The speed of light is about 300,000 meters per second. The speed of sound is about 340 meters per second. So one good thing, you know, to keep in mind, if you're watching the fireworks and you see the light, you know there's always a delay in hearing the sound from that. So if you're watching the fireworks that, let's say, they're about a kilometer away from you, it takes about 3/1,000,000th of a second for the light to reach you. So the sound takes about 3 seconds. So here's how you can tell how many kilometers away a firework is exploding. If you start counting seconds as soon as you see the explosion and then stop when you hear the explosion and divide that count by 3, that gives you the distance away in kilometers.
And another amazing thing about fireworks is those we see multi-stage ones, and there's so much control over the timing. Is it a matter of including, I don't know, catalysts and dampeners in the mix that help speed up or slow down a reaction?
Well, the firework is ignited by lighting a main fuse. That simultaneously starts both a fast action fuse, which quickly carries the flame down to the lift charge. You want to lift it. You don't want premature explosion. You want the firework to get up in the sky so we can all see it. And so there are different stages. And there's a time delay fuse which continues to burn as the firework is traveling upward toward up in the sky. And then when that fuse is ignited, then we see the explosions. Then we begin to hear the delayed sound that we hear. So the initial liftoff is critical. That's a different charge than what is involved in what happens in the upper stage. So in the lower stage, we have a low explosive. We have a burning charge that undergoes rapid decomposition but does not detonate. When we get to the higher stage, that's when the detonation takes place, and we create a sound boom. That's why we hear the loud explosion. An explosion is an uncontrolled combustion reaction. We all know about combustion reactions. You strike a match, you look at the flame of a candle. Those are controlled combustion reactions. But the explosions are all uncontrolled combustion reactions. They generate heat, sound, and light, but the sound is generated faster than it can be dissipated by the environment. It creates a sonic boom, and that's what we hear.
What do we know about the history of how fireworks first came to be?
Oh, my goodness. This is very old history. The Chinese are reported to have used fireworks 1,000 years ago, over 1,000 years ago. They used black powder, which is, you know, a form of coal. And basically the chemistry of what's going on hasn't changed very much since then. What has changed is the safety aspects of putting together all the ingredients to produce the beautiful, sparkling, scintillating visual effects that we enjoy, accompanied by a delayed reception of sound. That's what has changed over the years, and that's why it is critical that everyone sit back, enjoy the fireworks, enjoy the celebrations, but do not engage yourself or anyone else around you in setting off fireworks. Safety is very, very important. And could I say something else about fireworks?
Sure.
You know, we use them for celebrations. In this case, the celebrations of Independence Day today, where we celebrate freedom. We celebrate the independence that our country continues to enjoy. And I want to ask everyone in the listening audience to take some time and reflect about the true meaning of Independence Day. I know we call it the 4th of July in the United States, the 4th of July celebration, but you know what? There's a 4th of July in every country. This is Independence Day, and I urge everyone to read and reread the Declaration of Independence. It's a critical document that we all must really understand and subscribe to. I also urge everyone to read two other documents, the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I know the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, but it's called out, and I think it is critical on Independence Day, as we enjoy all types of celebrations, including fireworks and being with friends and family and others at small gatherings and big gatherings, to really remember and to celebrate and to salute America by reading the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights.
That's a good place to leave it, Bassam. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, and happy Independence Day to everyone.
That was Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, and we've been learning about the science behind fireworks. For more about that topic, you can visit Bassam's website. It's scifun.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Bickert. Americans are celebrating the 4th of July today with fireworks and flags, and with all that excitement, it can be easy to lose track of the history behind the day. Our next guest joins us to tell us about some of the uncanny connections between the 4th of July and the deaths of three American presidents. Brady Carlson is a WPR host and the author of Dead Presidents, an American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Brady, welcome to Central Time.
It's so great to be here. Thanks.
Well, you write that in terms of presidential deaths, timing matters.
Timing is everything.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it means that you can make a great exit that's very dramatic and sort of puts the finishing touches on a president's legacy, or a president can depart at the wrong time and can kind of undo everything that he's done in life. So the time and the manner in which you go out can have a huge impact on how you're remembered, if at all.
And today is the 4th of July, and apparently this almost became the unofficial departure date for presidents, kind of early on at least. And most famously, Adams and Jefferson both passed on the 4th of July. Can you tell us a little bit about their dual deaths on the 4th?
It was about as dramatic a way to go out as possible for the two of them. I mean, here are the two figures who, of course, the 4th of July celebrates the Declaration of Independence. And here are the two people who made the Declaration of Independence happen more than anyone else. Thomas Jefferson, of course, wrote it. But John Adams is the one who spoke before the Continental Congress for hours. And it was his fiery speech that unfortunately has been lost to history that really won over the Continental Congress and said, this is the right thing to do and this is the right time to do it. So here are these two figures who really helped make the country happen, helped it through the Revolution, helped it in the early days, became the second and third presidents, the first two vice presidents, huge, huge historical figures. They were longtime friends. They were sometimes rivals, but they had always been a part of each other's lives. And here we come to the 4th of July in 1826. It was the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
Of course, it was a nice round number like that.
Perfect number. I mean, you can't get a better story than that. And here are these two frail old figures. There are two of the three remaining members of that body that signed the Declaration of Independence and made it happen. And the two of them managed to sort of linger through poor health and difficulties, just kind of hanging on so that they could see that day happen. John Adams had been in and out of consciousness for days leading up to the 4th of July. Some people had come to his house beforehand and said, sir, you're John Adams. We would like you to give a toast for our local 4th of July celebration. And all he could say was, independence forever. That was the best he could give them.
It
was just two words. And yet then when he found out the 4th of July had finally come, he was himself again. He was sick and he was frail and he was feeble, but he said, this is a great day. This is a good day. And with that in mind, he just sort of declined and slipped away, but not before saying an interesting thing. He managed to mention his friend in Virginia. He was in Massachusetts. He said, Thomas Jefferson survives. What he didn't know, of course, was that Thomas Jefferson, who had been in much the same situation in Virginia, had died a few hours earlier.
So I was listening to those last words, reading those last words, and trying to figure out, was it sort of a bitter remembrance of Jefferson saying, darn it, you know, I'm going and Jefferson is still out there? Or was he thinking fondly of Jefferson? What's your take?
Isn't that a great question? Because they had been such bitter rivals when they ran for president against each other twice. And their supporters had leveled all kinds of horrible charges against them, that they were evil people and had done terrible things. And they did manage to sort of work together cordially, if coldly, for a while. And then they were very unhappy with each other for a while. But then they did come back together late in life and they became great correspondents. They would write each other long letters about life, about relationships, about the state of the country, about their favorite memories of the revolution. And I like to think that Adams was remembering his friend warmly. This is a day that they made happen together. And if he was going to go out, he was going to think of his friend one last time. Now, Jefferson was in no condition to be talking to anybody about anything, really. He was in even worse shape leading up to the 4th of July in 1826. And his family at one point was so worried that he wasn't going to make it to the 4th that they lied to him. They told him the 3rd of July was actually Independence Day. And they said that when he heard that he sort of relaxed. He had been very agitated and not comfortable. And then he just seemed to have a very peaceful expression on his face, like, this is what I had always wanted. I'm finally getting my dream realized. And then, of course, he did hang around a bit longer and died on the 4th of July
itself.
On the
actual 4th of July, not the day that his family had told him was the 4th of July, which is so interesting. And you get into this a little bit in your book about whether, you know, someone can actually hold on and linger in that fashion to hit a milestone. What did you end up thinking about that?
There's some interesting research about how people can kind of put themselves off of dying on a particular day. There are two other presidents. Gerald Ford is one and Harry Truman is the other, who both died on December 26th. And Gerald Ford's family was always convinced that he didn't want his family to have that remembrance of him dying on Christmas. So he just managed to will himself to stick around a day longer. And there's some research that suggests maybe people can do that for a bit of time. But it could also just be one of those one in a million coincidences. You know, you have these important figures, and these important moments, these dates that matter to people. You know, we pick the number 50 arbitrarily. It doesn't necessarily mean anything in the grand scheme of the cosmos, but it's important to us. And so we could also be just creating this great narrative that, you know, what a perfect way to go out for two people on the 4th of July.
We're talking to Brady Carlson right now. He's a WPR host and the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And Brady, in your book, you talk about kind of what happens next to these leaders and their memories. I mean, it seems so strange that the two of them would go on the same day. But in looking at the 4th of July, they're not the only presidents who did this or certainly came really close to dying on the 4th.
That's true. In fact, up to that point, the only other president who had not died on the 4th of July was George Washington. So 5 years after this grand exit by Adams and Jefferson, you have the fifth president, James Monroe, who is a Virginian but is living with his family in New York because he'd had some financial difficulties and some health ones as well. And he managed to pass away on the 4th of July in 1831 as well. And just as people in 1826 had said, well, this is a clear sign of the meaning of the 4th of July and the meaning of freedom and the importance of America, that these two leaders should die on Independence Day. People said the same things about James Monroe, that here's yet another president who's passing away on the 4th of July. 5 years after Monroe's death in New York, we have James Madison, yet another Virginia president, and he's declining in late June. And the doctors are saying, oh, this could be another 4th of July death. Wouldn't it be fantastic if we could keep the streak going? And so they started thinking, well, you know, maybe Madison will make it. Maybe he won't. So what can we do to help him? They started offering him stimulants and medicines and other drugs to kind of ease his pain, almost like a, you know, 1800s hospice care in a way. But let's see if we can sort of help him over the finish line and get him to the 4th of July. The only thing was James Madison himself said, no thanks, I'm not really interested in that. He was sitting at the breakfast table one morning in late June and just kind of said, that's going to be it. He couldn't swallow any of the food, and someone asked him what was wrong. He said, nothing but a change of mind, my dear. And right then, he just slumped over and died.
Wow. So interesting. So we have three presidents, though, who did pass away on the 4th of July, Jefferson, Adams, and Monroe. How did the nation react to this? Not only the loss of a president, which is still a big deal today, not only as someone who founded the nation, but any president. And then you have them passing on the 4th of July. Did people get worked up about that?
Very worked up. It was one of those moments where people started to, you know, you hear people talking about the divine intervention. People said, well, this is the best sign you could possibly have that God is on the side of the United States of America. In fact, John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, was president of the United States in 1826. And he wrote in his diary, he said, well, these circumstances can't be a coincidence. This couldn't have just happened by accident. This is a sign of divine favor for the United States and the people who have fought so hard to make it what it is today. And that's how people across the country reacted in each of these cases on the 4th of July.
And so you, as the biographer, I'm going to put you in the hot seat. Do you think it was some kind of divine providence saying, hey, United States, you know, this is a special moment? Or do you think that this is just a little eerie?
I tend to think that it's one of those cases where these two figures who had been able to work their will on history managed to do it one last time. They were both clearly looking forward to...
Was that a deliberate Hamilton quote?
It was just an eerie Hamilton quote. And I think they just had to hang in there because they thought, if this is how we're going to go out, we got to make it at least until the 4th.
It's definitely an amazing story.
No doubt about that.
And Brady Carlson stays with us. He's a WPR host and the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And we're talking about the surprising stories behind the deaths of U.S. presidents, including some mysterious ties to the 4th of July. And we'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Brady Carlson stays with us on this 4th of July. He's a WPR host and the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. We're talking about some of the surprising stories behind the deaths of some U.S. presidents and checking out some of the uncanny ties to the 4th of July as well. And Brady, looking again back at the timing of presidential deaths, you write that bad timing might have eclipsed the reputation of William Henry Harrison. He had a really short term in office.
30 days, the shortest of all time. And you can, in the same way that you can really burnish your reputation by a great exit, a really bad exit can do the exact opposite. And William Henry Harrison is truly the perfect exhibit of that. Harrison was a war hero. He had served in government. He was a territorial governor in the Midwest. He was one of the most popular figures in his time in the first half of the 19th century. And yet, the only thing anybody remembers about him today is that he caught pneumonia and died 30 days into his term as president, the shortest serving president of all time. That's all anybody ever remembers about this guy, who was as big a figure in his time as anybody. I mean, we remember Andrew Jackson, who was a big, important player because he was a very strong president, controversial certainly, but a figure who left his mark on the presidency and on American history. Harrison had left his mark on American history, but as a president, all he did was get sick and die. So we look away from all of the things that he did do because when a person is president, that's first and foremost what they did, whether that was successful or not. So everything else that he did sort of gets wiped away by that. If you visit his tomb in southwestern Ohio, you can get a better sense of who he was and the totality of his career because you see all of the different jobs that he had held, all the different roles that he had played, and a little bit of the impact that he had made on the people of the country at that time. But if you just look at him on that list of presidents and see he served from March to April 1841 and managed to be the first person to die as a sitting president, that doesn't really give you a full sense of who he is. And yet that's what he gets remembered for now.
Do the folks in Ohio hold him in higher esteem and have a better sense of all of his accomplishments than the nation at large?
Tiny, tiny bit. I mean, he's just largely become a forgotten figure because there are so many other bigger, more well-remembered presidents. And that's true even in Ohio. There are so many Ohio presidents, and he just winds up being another name on the list for the most part. There are people, and I ran across them when I was in the area, who are running a museum that are dedicated to try and get the word out a little bit more about who he was and the important role that he played in his time. But they're really swimming against the tide. I mean, the longer the time goes on, the more ingrained our sense of a particular president gets. You know, they each get basically a sentence or two in a history book, if that. And we just, over time, increasingly remember that one sentence or those two sentences about a lesser well-known president.
Well, and part of this, as you were talking about, is, you know, this the way that he ended up dying and ending that presidency. I mean, it seems as though when you read about him, it's almost, you know, treated as a subject of poor judgment in the best case and humor in the worst case, because he gave this really long, by all accounts, really boring speech in really bad weather. And why wasn't he wearing a coat? You know, the sentiment seems to be, why didn't his mother teach him to wear a coat? So why wasn't he wearing a coat?
It's a perfectly legitimate question to ask when you're out in a snowstorm. Shouldn't you be wearing a coat? William Henry Harrison was kind of a rural guy. He had been used to inspecting fields and owning plantations and things like that. So he'd also been a military man. So he was used to being out in the field, maybe with a coat, maybe not. I mean, he wasn't a real formal guy or anything like that. And he also had this thing hanging over his shoulder in that he was not really part of the political elite, so to speak. The Washington classes were used to sort of picking presidents from their own, you know, the sort of intellectually gifted sort of people like a Thomas Jefferson or a John Adams. And here comes this sort of frontier general without the pomp and grandeur of a George Washington or the great reputation as a military thinker that he would have. Harrison was well regarded, but not thought of as a real heavyweight thinker. So he was kind of considered just a party man who was going to do whatever the party bosses told him to do. And he wanted to prove himself as a real strong thinker. He also wanted to prove that as the oldest president ever elected up to that point, that he was physically up to the job. So he thought, okay, I'm going to give a long speech, show I've got the stamina, show I've got the brains. And he wound up showing that he was prone to catching pneumonia. Although it should be said, there's been some new research in the last few years that suggested he might have actually been a victim of the water system at the time in Washington, D.C.
Interesting.
So he might have actually just caught a bug that people tended to catch in Washington, D.C. in those times, and that it wasn't really the pneumonia or the speech or any of that. He might have just caught a cold coincidentally at the same time and wound up being done in by something entirely different. But nonetheless, you know, the perception is reality. We remember William Henry Harrison for not wearing the coat and for catching the cold and for dying, no matter how it actually happened.
We're talking to Brady Carlson right now, WPR host and the author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leader. And Brady, Ulysses S. Grant, he has a really interesting end-of-life story, one that I hadn't heard before, a giant of the Civil War, and it kind of looked like his last years were going to be miserable, in part because he had had a diagnosis, which turned out to be fatal, and also financially he was in ruins at the same time. Pick it up there. What sort of shape is he in right there?
He had been swindled out of all of his life savings by a business partner who was conducting sort of an old school Ponzi scheme of sorts. And at the same time, doctors had discovered a terminal cancer. So he had a year to live and no money, and he was terrified. He wanted to make sure that his wife and his children were taken care of. And the only thing that he had left really to offer them was a book. And he started writing his memoirs of the Civil War. His presidency was not a terribly happy time for him. So he looked back on his great career achievements as leading the Union armies. And he started writing about that. He lined up a publisher who was maybe not going to offer the financial security that he had hoped for. So a friend of the Grant family, Mark Twain, stepped forward and said, I can get you a better deal than this publisher can. And basically started a publishing house just for Grant's memoirs. Now, remember, Grant was living in New York City at the time, and when word got out that he was dying, everyone in the world wanted to go pay their respects to him. So he's trying to write a book, and everybody's interrupting him constantly. So he wound up doing his best in New York City until he decided to move to upstate New York at a place called Mount McGregor. There's a beautiful cottage there, and the family just spent a couple of months getting into the quiet summer air. They thought it would be better for his health than the polluted New York City air of the time. And he just worked and worked and worked and worked and tried to finish up this book. And 3 days after the manuscript was finished, he died.
Wow.
And the book then went on to generate hundreds of thousands of dollars, would have been millions in the money of today. And
so he did take care of his family.
He wound up doing exactly what he set out to do.
Well, you actually visited that cottage, is known as Grant's Cottage, which I gather is not a huge tourist destination. But what was it? What is it like? What did you see?
It's off the beaten path. It's a beautiful spot. It's a scenic location. We were there on kind of a foggy day, so you had these beautiful fall colors in the trees and then the misty fog kind of around it. It's a very calm, quiet place. The big front porch where you could sit down and get work done if you wanted to. Just a serene place where you could take care of a project like this and also just spend time with family. There were some old veterans of the Civil War who would stand outside because people knew where he was. But those old veterans made sure that if anybody came by and said, oh, we wanted to pay our respects to General Grant, they said, no, he's got work to do. You got to leave him alone.
He's writing a book.
He needs peace and quiet.
Oh, so interesting. In your book, you do have a picture of him, and he looks like he's very engrossed in what he's doing out on that front porch. And you actually saw inside just a couple of rooms, including his sick room, which had some sort of grim reminders of what he must have been going through, even while he's trying to churn out this book.
He was given a concoction of cocaine and water to deal with the pain that he was going through from the tumors in his mouth and his throat. He could not eat anything, so he was just being fed through liquids. And they would scrape all of that gunk out of his throat as often as they could. And that's without anesthetics. You know, the cocaine helped a little bit. But I mean, just a grueling ordeal. Not to mention that when you're, you know, dying of cancer, you can be exhausted and you just want to rest. But he carried on as best he could until he got done what he had intended to do so that he could see that his family was okay.
And you see his will sort of just present there until the very end.
He made it happen, you know, and people said this is keeping him alive. This idea of finishing this book is keeping him alive. So it's not really a surprise that once he had the book done and he could set his mind at ease about his family, that he moved on.
Brady, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brady Carlson is a WPR host. You can hear him weekdays on All Things Considered. And he's also the author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. And he joined us to talk about the deaths of some U.S. presidents and also tell us some of those uncanny stories about U.S. presidents passing on today, the 4th of July.